Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Tuesday, July 21st, 2026. I'm Lee Robartis. In the news tonight, Idaho Fire Suppression Fund has $15 million negative balance. Fires in eastern Washington, including two major fires along the Columbia River on the Colville Reservation. Moscow Council hears about Human Rights Commission projects, including welcoming dinner. And Post Falls Police Department, first city police department in Idaho to sign contract with ICE. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. The Post Falls Police Department signed a 287G agreement with ICE earlier this month, becoming the first Idaho city to do so. The 287G agreements allow city police to enforce federal immigration law. According to ICE, the Idaho State Police and 10 county sheriff's offices in the state have signed the agreements with it. The signing comes at a time when tensions are flaring between Americans and the violent federal agency. Senators Patty Murray and Maria Cantwell in neighboring Washington have decried ICE's extra-legal attacks on suspected illegal immigrants and U.S. citizens and have indicated illegal immigration is not a national security threat, as Trump insists. Under the 287G agreement, four Post Falls police officers and a captain will train with ICE for 40 hours and learn a federal computerized system to determine someone's status and detain them if they are in the country without permission. Police Captain Brian Harrison claims 15 officers volunteered for the training, and some of them were children of immigrants who speak English as a second language. According to the spokesman in review, Post Falls Mayor Randy Westland said in a statement, "We are proud to continue our partnership with federal law enforcement to keep our city safe, and we reiterate our commitment to enforcing the law. This partnership advances these goals and strengthens our community." Mayor Westland's commitment to human rights is in question when the city council voted in February to not recognize Juneteenth as a holiday and instead recognize Columbus Day. Westland claimed nobody had heard of Juneteenth until 5 years ago and that it was pushed for political purposes. Human Rights Watch reported in June 52 people had died in ICE custody since Trump took over the presidency for a second time in January 2026. ICE agents have also murdered 4 people in public so far this year, with no accountability for the shooters. ICE claimed the killings were necessary because victims were set to attack ICE or weaponize their vehicles, although video and witness testimony counters that narrative. Kootenai County also has a 287G agreement with ICE, and the spokesman review has obtained records that the U.S. Homeland Security Department has reimbursed the Kootenai County Jail $95,000 since August of last year for holding federal detainees. There are 3 prongs to the ICE program that local jurisdictions can use. One is the jail enforcement model, which allows local jails to hold non-citizens and immigrants while agents assess them. Another is a warrant model, which allows agents to train local officers to carry out federal warrants. And the third is the task force model, which delegates local police and deputies to perform immigration agent duties. Kootenai County began using the jail enforcement model and the warrant model in August of last year. Captain Harrison of the Post Falls Police Department says his department will be using the warrant model. Idaho Lands Department Director Dustin Miller told the Idaho Land Board today the state has already spent millions on wildfire suppression this year. Miller said his department has spent $15 million more dollars on wildfire suppression than it has in its account. The state is relying on what they call deficiency warrants to later reimburse the Department of Lands for the firefighting that occurs.
Independent meat producers in the Pacific Northwest are decrying a move by the U.S. Department of Agriculture to repeal three rules they say prevented discrimination in the meat and poultry industries. One 2024 rule barred meat processing facilities from retaliating against producers based on race, gender, or co-op membership. Alice Morrison of Friends of Family Farmers warns that limited access to USDA-inspected facilities already stifles independent growers, and the rollback will only worsen the bottleneck.
Our farmers are getting 12 to 18 month wait times quoted to them for processing slots. Before you even start the farm, you need to figure out your processing, because if there's no way to bring your product to market, you shouldn't dig yourself into that financial hole of raising those animals.
Morrison explains rescinding the rules will allow processing facilities to favor farmers with corporate contracts over smaller operations. National Chicken Council President Mike Brown called the rules anti-business and said they would lead to higher prices for consumers. Food and Water Watch staff attorney Emily Miller says the rules were put in place in order to counter the effects of what she calls hyper-consolidation in the meat industry. She says currently just four companies control the majority of chicken and pork processing and 85% of beef processing. She adds removing the rules will prioritize corporate interests.
We need robust enforcement of antitrust and fair trade practice laws to finally protect producers from unfair and illegal conduct. And unfortunately, these rollbacks will do just the opposite.
Research shows that monopolies on feed, fertilizer, and processing plants lead to higher prices for consumers and lower profits for farmers. I'm Isabel Charlet, Washington News Service.
KRFP is supported by listeners like you and by Moscow Ale House, with something for everyone in the family. You can find Moscow Ale House at 226 West 6th Street or call 208-882-BREW. That's 208-882-2739.
KRFP thanks its listeners and sponsors for helping make this programming possible.
Community radio is all about building community.
Well, you know I have a love for everyone I know.
In a world built to kill us, survival is a radical act, so donate today.
And you know I have a drive to live, I won't let go.
In these turbulent times when the focus is on survival, KRFP will bring you the news and entertainment that will help you survive. In these dark times, KRFP will aspire that nobody who is marginalized or under attack will be abandoned or silenced. Your donation will help guarantee that independent voices are still available on the airwaves. KRFP is always focusing on community building.
If you received a KRFP end-of-the-year fundraising letter, quickly open it, read how we are here to build community, and then donate to keep our all-important 1100-watt FM signal on the air.
Don't be afraid to donate. You will reap benefits in the form of community engagement that will change your life forever. You can also find the KRFP fundraising letter at www.krfp.org.
Three major wildfires are burning in eastern Washington, including the 62,873-acre Kaiser Canyon Fire, which has surrounded the community of Nespelem on the Colville Reservation. There were 473 personnel fighting the blaze as of last night. A lightning strike a mile from Nespelem on the Colville Reservation Thursday morning caused the blaze. The fire grew in flashy fuels and strong wind gusts. The town of Nespelem and a number of nearby campgrounds and roads are under Level 3 Go Now evacuation orders. 1,000 people are displaced and 800 structures are threatened. The Seattle Times reported Sunday that the town of Nespelem is intact but has been surrounded by flames less than 2 miles away. At least 10 structures had been destroyed as of Sunday. The latest INSEEWEB report on the Kaiser Canyon fire last night said structure protection and community safety are the primary goals of the firefighting effort. Incident Commander Aaron Thompson of the Northern Rockies Incident Management Team Number 2 said managers have ordered additional resources to fight the blaze, which is 0% contained. The report says, rapid wind-driven fire growth has pushed the fire front north and northeast of Nespelum toward Omak Lake. Road closures and evacuations continue near the fire perimeter for community and firefighter safety. Very active fire behavior has also pushed the fire into conifer forested areas, which has increased fire length and forward movement. It's been 1.5 years since the Idaho State Board of Education dismantled various campus institutions that focused on diversity and making the community more welcoming, but the Moscow Human Rights Commission is doing some of that work that the state government has abandoned. At last night's Moscow City Council meeting, newly elected Moscow Human Rights Commission Vice Chair Nick Smiley said the commission both does its own activities and provides support to other efforts in the community.
Our mission is to affirm, encourage, and initiate programs and services within the city designed to eliminate discrimination, improve human relations, and effectuate the spirit and intent of human rights legislation. And these efforts, the commission may enlist support of community groups, public agencies. And I would say that really the backbone of what we do is we work with a coalition of various organizations in the community to try to empower this mission, right? Most of what we do is collaborative. But we do from time to time have our own events. We do sometimes just piggyback and lend support to other events. You guys are aware of some of that.
Human Rights Commission member Jana Argesinger went into detail about the commission's Better Together dinner and its positive impact on the community, as well as their participation in the group Welcoming America's Rural Initiative.
This was something that we hosted, but thanks to budgetary support from the city, but also in partnership with the task force, the Latah County Human Rights Task Force, the ASUI, LDS House, the Unitarian Universalist Church of the Palouse, among other groups. This event was open to the public with a particular focus on university students that are new to our town and those from marginalized communities. So our particular aim with this event was to learn directly from those students and members of the community at large about their experience of welcome and challenge in Moscow, and to hear their ideas about how we can strengthen the web of support and belonging for everybody. The audience and the ongoing aim distinguished the Better Together dinner from other community dinners in Moscow. I know that was a question that the council had when we presented before, and so that was something we really took seriously and tried to sharpen as we planned. So we had, it was a success on multiple levels. 60 people attended from across campus and town, representing varied age groups, places of origin, and programs of study. There are some more details about that in the report itself. Our venue was LDS House, adjacent to campus, a shift from the original 1912 center plan as advised by City Council. The folks at this venue were extraordinarily gracious and welcoming in a variety of ways. They provided a beautiful non-religious gathering space, large enough for 100 guests at no cost. They provided a lot of different things and a lot of hands-on dishwashing, tablecloths, all kinds of things. It was really a wonderful experience. And they said it was because they have a shared goal to make sure everybody in our community feels welcome. I think the thing I want to emphasize most about this dinner is that it was a listening dinner. At least one host from either the Human Rights Commission or the Human Rights Task Force sat with other guests and students at small round tables to share a meal, to listen, to ask questions, and take notes. The students and the other guests described features of Moscow that help them feel at home, others that hurt, and ideas for positive action. The strengths that I have listed again here, you can look through those. One of the things that came up a fair amount was town-university relations. Some felt good about that, thought it was healthy. Others not so much. Concerns, and this was one of our interests in having this dinner, was whether students, especially new students, and marginalized students were being affected by the closure of identity-specific centers on campus. And there were concerns. There were some definite concerns that you can read about here about people feeling fearful about speaking freely, about censorship in education, about just support in the community at large. So one of our aims was to learn if there are things that we can do and that other organizations in town can do to help, you know, fill in those services. And it was extremely illuminating in that regard. Some of the positive actions that people suggested, a big one was really just a broad welcoming campaign, which we see as in line with this mission statement's emphasis in the city code on the city as a leader in human rights and civil rights. So one option under consideration, this is going to be the second item and the other document that you've got, is that we are looking to apply for a 2027 Rural Welcoming Initiative of the National Welcoming America Organization. And I'll give you a little bit more about that in a minute. In the meantime, while we look at applying for that, there are a number of individual measures that we have listed that, again, were provided by our guests while we're applying for this particular program. And a lot of them, again, have to do with strengthening town and university integration. There are some really, really great ideas that we gathered there. There are also some current and recent programs that are already responsive to student concerns. Given what we learned, and this really sort of follows on the success of the Better Together Dinner, we have done research on what is, again, called the Rural Welcoming Initiative, and it's under the aegis of the national nonprofit Welcoming America. And this is an initiative, this rural initiative, is something that they make available to communities of 50,000 residents or fewer. Welcoming America is a leader in the welcoming movement, and its motto is building a nation of neighbors. They help communities, quote, become more prosperous by ensuring everyone belongs, including immigrants. And in Moscow, this would include, of course, first-year and international students like those who attended our dinner and shared their concerns among other groups. There's a specific list of the benefits that would come with this initiative, and if we were chosen for the cohort for 2027, one of the big beauties of it is it's completely no cost, completely free. We wouldn't have to come to you for money. And there are some very, very important supportive things that would come along with this, with participation in this program, including tailored technical assistance, program and resource development, rural local to local community partnerships. Not only is it no cost, but they would give us a stipend, or the program and its partners, a stipend of approximately $1,200 for hosting or supporting a Welcoming Week 2027 event. And that could be a dinner like the one we did, or another kind of event, and a membership in their very, very large and growing Welcoming America network. And then potential for working toward a much bigger goal, which would be certification as a welcoming city. Under their larger organization, Boise, among 45 cities nationwide, has already won certification there. And I think I will end then by saying there are links in your document, and also I hope you get them digitally by email, to the Rural Welcoming Initiative itself and also to the Welcoming America website. And so I will end by saying I think that the perspective of the commission is that taking part in this initiative aligns squarely with the HRC's official mission as stated in city code and with the city's commitment in that section to continued leadership in, quote, extending equal opportunity to its inhabitants.
That was Moscow Human Rights Commission member Jana Argesinger speaking to the city council last night. Council members at the meeting expressed support for the city's collaboration with Welcoming America's Rural Initiative.
Along with thinking about back-to-school supplies and schedules, Oregon doctors are reminding families now is the time to plan annual wellness appointments for their children. Known as well child visits, yearly checkups ensure kids are on track with vaccines, growth, and overall development so they are ready physically and emotionally to go back to school. Oregon Clinic pediatrician Dr. Meredith Grover says families sometimes skip visits when no vaccines are due, but she stresses that maintaining a relationship with your pediatrician nutrition is still important.
For the growth of the children, to make sure their speech is on track, to make sure their physical development's on track. Are they moving in the way they're supposed to at their age? These are all things that a parent might not be aware of if they're only coming in for the shot visits.
Grover emphasizes that looking at a child's growth over time, including their height and weight, gives important insights into their nutrition and other issues that arise. The more data, the better, she says, so yearly visits are helpful. Dr. Rhonda Randall with United Healthcare says checkups are not just about physical health. She points to research from the CDC showing about 1 in 5 children between the ages of 3 and 17 has had a behavioral or mental health diagnosis. She explains mental health struggles can look different depending on the age.
For a younger child, you might see issues with behavior or separation anxiety. Older children might have issues with stress or attention or friendships or grades.
Randall adds mental health concerns have been increasing in children in the last couple years, data that's backed up by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. She says it's helpful to catch any issues early so kids can get the support they need. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
A decades-long drought with no end in sight is stirring debate among environmental experts in Wyoming and other western states. Climate change is exacerbating conditions for more frequent and severe wildfires, but as climatologist Trent Ford with the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign explains, changing precipitation patterns are just one driver of dried-out trees and other vegetation that fuel these fires.
Warming trends have enhanced evaporation, so how much water is leaving the land going up to the atmosphere as gas. Warmer temperatures during the winter has also caused less precipitation to fall as snow.
After a near-record dry winter, Wyoming recorded its driest spring in decades. Today, the vast majority of the state is experiencing extreme or severe drought. Experts with the National Weather Service's office in Riverton report that the monsoon season expected in late July could bring relief, but it would need to rain every day for several weeks to improve drought conditions. As Wyoming struggles to manage shrinking water supplies, water policy researcher Elizabeth Cobley with the University of Nevada, Reno, notes cities and other municipalities are tapping just 20% of the region's water.
80% of our water goes to agriculture. About 55% of our water use also goes to growing alfalfa hay, essentially feed for cattle.
Cobley believes the biggest opportunities to save water are in the agricultural sector. In 2024, alfalfa farms in the Colorado River Basin drew more than 2 trillion gallons of water, enough to supply 40 million people for more than 3 years. The amount of hay exported to places like China and Saudi Arabia has more than doubled over the past 2 decades.
If we're really going to solve some of the deeper problems associated with drought and long-term water scarcity, at least in the Western United States, we really need to be thinking about where most of our water is used.
This is Eric Galatis reporting for the Wyoming News Service.
And that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather, patchy smoke overnight with widespread haze, mostly cloudy, low 59. Tomorrow, areas of smoke with widespread haze, sunny, high 92, partly cloudy Wednesday night, low 59, 20% chance of showers and thunderstorms afternoon on Thursday, mostly sunny, high 93, 20% chance of showers and thunderstorms before midnight Thursday night, mostly clear, low 58, and mostly clear Friday through Sunday, with highs 91 Friday, 87 Saturday, and 82 on Sunday, lows 56 Friday night and 53 Saturday night, and breezy. Currently 90 degrees. The Washington Department of Ecology real-time air monitoring map shows that the air quality at this hour in Pullman is moderate. And the Idaho Department of Environmental Quality real-time air monitoring shows the air quality at this point in Moscow is moderate as well. It's moderate in all of northern and north central Idaho except Cottonwood, where it is unhealthy. And if you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Or you can go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. There's a drop-down box that says Support KRFP. You can underwrite programming, which is a cost-effective way of letting our listeners know your business or nonprofit supports community radio. You can adopt a DJ. There's a PayPal option and a Patreon button as well. Once again, we'll gladly accept checks of any amount at KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. I'm Lee Robartis. Have a good night. Flashpoints is up next. 7:30, Rude Awakenings on the air. Stay tuned for more.
Programming on KRFP is made possible in part by support from KRFP members and
John's Alley Tavern, Moscow's home of live music. John's Alley is located at 114 East 6th Street in downtown Moscow.
Programming on KRFP is also sponsored by Friends of the Clearwater, a 501c3 environmental nonprofit dedicated to protecting your public lands. FOC is defending the wildlands, wildlife, and waterways of north central Idaho for future generations. Friendsoftheclearwater.org.
KRFP, Moscow Pullman. Putting the wattage into your cottage.